The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm live in the New York studio with my good friend Mark Hochstein from Source Media, American Banker, Mark, and Bank Think. Yeah, good to have you back. So this week we've got a lot to get through. We are the first and number one global fintech radio show in the world. First off, before we get into the show today, we are going to get into conference announcements. I'm having trouble talking today, obviously. As Sam said last week, we're now the Groupon of conferences for fintech. All the fintech conferences come through here. So Columbia Summit at Columbia University, June 8 and 9. Day two is the Innovators and Investors Day. You can go to dfssummit.com to register and use the code BREAKINGBANKS for a 25% discount. Findeva, June 12 and 13th in London. You can use the BBANKSDEVA20 code. Of course, you can go to the conference page at Breaking Banks and BreakingBanks.com and find all of these as well. Next Money is having their Next Money Southeast Conference in Charlotte, North Carolina, June 21st. JP Nichols is going to be there. And of course, we have a 25% discount on that too. You can go to se17.nextmoney.org. And we're also pleased to announce that NTT Data is sponsoring Breaking Banks and the FinTech 5 as the podcast partners for Money 2020 Europe and United States. We'll be there podcasting from the Money 2020 venue as the official podcast partner of Money 2020, talking with the key speakers and attendees at the event. We're going to see you there in the main hall. Now, don't forget, Finovate Fall is also coming up September 11 to 17. You can check that out. Of course, you get the Breaking Banks 20 discount code there as well. And last but not least, American Banker is having their Blockchain and Digital Currencies Conference on June 13, 2017. And you can use the code BREAKING and get $150 off registration there as well. So in the news, you could see the news that Alipay has moved into local currency payments in Hong Kong. That's bound to be a very interesting move because Hong Kong's been a little later than China in terms of the mobile payment stuff. In terms of P2P, HSBC just launched a P2P service a few months ago in Hong Kong. So to have some competition from the 800-pound panda from over the border in China is going to be huge. Dubai has also announced they're going to be allowing licenses for fintech startups through the central bank there with it's called a temporary financial services license, but that's going to be interesting to see how that takes off. Of course, the big news this week is Bitcoin is blowing up, surging, as well as Ether, and it's on track to hit $3,000 per Bitcoin right now. Isn't it crazy, Mark? How are you going for Bitcoins? You still keep some of your Bitcoins? Okay, sorry. For some reason, we weren't hearing you there.
Oh.
Mark, we'll try and figure that out as we go. But before we do that, let's just jump in because we'll try and get you talking about consensus in a moment. But before that, let's just let's invite our first guest to the show, and we'll get some Q&A going here. Greg Cross is calling in all the way from Auckland in New Zealand. And he is the chief business officer for Soul Machines. Now, I don't know whether you saw the news on this, but Soul Machines, they're developing a smart assistant, emotionally responsive avatars as a user interface for AI systems. And this is a University of Auckland spin-off based on BabyX technology created by Dr. Mark Sagard down there and his engineering team. What is interesting is that this tech that they've used for The Voice. They've actually used a very famous actor to voice this smart assistant, Nadia, virtual assistant. So, Greg, are you there?
Yeah, I am, Brett. Good morning.
So, what time is it over there in Auckland?
Just after 7 o'clock on Friday morning. So, in this part of the world, we can say, thank God it's Friday already.
Absolutely. Well, so tell me about Nadia and who is the voice actress you've used?
Yeah, so Nadia is a digital human that we've created specifically for the National Disability Insurance Association in Australia. And in creating Nadia and bringing her to life, we've actually been privileged to use the voice of Cate Blanchett. To be the interface for 500,000 disabled people with disability in Australia.
That's pretty crazy. So how did you get Cate Blanchett involved?
The folks from NDIA approached Cate. One of them had gone to school with Cate, so it always goes back to our childhood days some way, somehow. And Cate was only too happy to get engaged in this specific project, helping people with disability.
And what did you guys record it in a sound booth, or and how did you go through the process of creating the enough vocabulary that you could now have enough to power the virtual AI?
To power Nadia. So the Mark, our inventor, and a couple of our sound team actually flew to the Gold Coast in Australia, where Cate was recording, was filming one of the productions she was in, and we spent Mark and a couple of our guys spent two or three late evenings recording Cate's voice, and then we set her up with a laptop and a microphone, and I think after Gold Coast she moved on to London, so she took that with her and continued recording the rest of what we required at that point in time. So there was 30 or 40 hours of time required to record Cate's voice, and then a few weeks of post-processing time for our technology guys to turn it into Nadia's voice and be able to produce all the content that we required for this particular digital employee.
Now, why was the technology called Baby X? I mean, I know the answer, but for the audience, why did you call the voice technology Baby X?
Mark and the team, Mark came up with the name, Baby X, because it was the first generation of his digital babies. So Baby X is actually based on the likeness of one of Mark's children.
There you go. And how is this tech going to be used? You said it's going to be used to help those in the field of disability, but specific the National Disability Insurance Scheme specifically. But you've got emotionally responsive tech in this. What does that mean?
Yeah. So first off. The Nadia application or the Nadia avatar is really just the first of what will be literally hundreds and hundreds of digital employees that we'll put to work for different companies and different industries around the world. So it really is just the first application. So the core of our technology is what we call our human computing engine. So behind the Nadia's pretty face and very lifelike behavior and features is what we call our human computing engine, which is effectively made up of biologically inspired models of different parts of the human brain. So I mean, the reason Nadia behaves in a very human-like way is because she actually is seeing and hearing using many of the same sorts of systems or models of many of the same sorts of systems that we have as humans.
Very, very interesting. So you guys took in some funding in, was it November last year or late last year from a Hong Kong venture firm. You know, how soon before this is actually live and rolled out commercially?
Yes, that's correct. We took on our Series A funding from Horizons Ventures out of Hong Kong in July of last year. So they led a Series A funding round for us. So at that point, we became Soul Machines and completed the spin out from the university. The team's grown to just on 40 of us at this point in time. We have a number of different applications, excuse me, that we're working on with some big customers in the US and Europe, and also, as you'd expect, in this part of the world as well. So I'd expect you to see some more announcements on some of the sorts of digital employees that we're creating for different companies early in 2018.
So by 2025, you know, smart assistants, you know, voice user interface, voice AI, you know, this tech's going to be pretty common. How integrated do you think voice assistants will be or smart assistants will be in our life in, you know, 7 years' time?
We think they'll be a big part of our lives in 5 years' time. We see a lot of the large organizations we deal with on a day-to-day basis will be using digital humans like Nadia and Rachel and Roman, who are a couple of the other ones that we've already created to deliver customer services, to provide you to be able to sell you new products and services. So we'll certainly see them as we interact with big business and government agencies over the next 5 years. And it's likely we'll also have these sorts of digital agents in our cars, for example, as acting as a concierge as we go from point A to point B, potentially in our homes. So we're already seeing devices like Alexa and Google Home become very, very popular, adding a face and human-like expression is just another step.
Yep, absolutely. All right, so Greg, look, thanks for getting up so early in the morning for us in Auckland to tell us about Nadia and the whole experience, and we look forward to hearing more about your progress.
Awesome. Thanks, Brett. Appreciate your...
Where can people find out more about your tech, just quickly?
Just at soulmachines.com.
Very good.
You can find us there and a whole bunch of videos of some of the digital humans we're creating.
Fantastic. All right, guys, listen, you're listening to Breaking Banks. We're going to have a quick break here and try and fix Mark's microphone, and we'll be back after this very brief break.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, you are back with Brett King, and we have Mark Hochstein here too.
Loud and clear.
Can we all hear Mark now? I hope so. So listen, hey Mark, You were at Consensus this week. Tell me a bit what's happening at Consensus in New York with all the blockchain tech.
Well, it's really interesting, Brett, because on the one hand, you still have a lot of interest and a lot of money pouring into enterprise blockchain. You still have these enterprise software projects and startups that are, you know, much like the sort of second wave of fintech, they're trying to do business with the banks. And so that continues. But at the same time, the coins, the cryptocurrencies.
The coins are just...
Yeah, they're back with a vengeance.
Yeah.
And it's not just Bitcoin. I mean, you mentioned that Bitcoin is well into the 2000s now. But, you know, you have all these what they call ICOs, initial coin offerings,
yep,
coming out. It's making a lot of people in that community a little bit nervous, simply because there's some questions about whether these amount to unregistered security sales.
Yep.
Now, I don't know that that's true of all of them. I mean, I think some of them, you know, some of them are interesting. I think that the transaction or the crowd sale that Brave, the browser company, is doing, yep, with their basic attention token, basically creating a token that lives on top of the Ethereum platform that would reward users for viewing ads, would reward publishers. They're trying to make a sort of a fairer bargain on the internet. I think that's interesting, and in theory, at least, that has some value within a closed ecosystem. Mm. So some of these tokens, you know, you could think of them the way that maybe we thought of subway tokens,
yeah,
back in New York in the 70s, or maybe when you buy tickets at a carnival, you have tickets that are redeemable for cotton candy or various rides.
Yep.
You know, they have value within a certain ecosystem. But, you know, some of these are pretty dubious as well, some of these other ones. So there was, a lot of nervous laughter around that. You know, there's a bubble, probably a bubble across all asset classes, not just cryptocurrency, yeah, that's playing a part here, too.
That's a whole big discussion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really interesting to see. Did you see the news that R3 finally closed their round?
Yeah. So they have raised money from their member banks, which by all accounts took some doing.
Still, they did raise $107 million. So
yeah, not bad.
Not a small amount.
No. So worth the wait.
Gives them a bit of runway.
Yeah. You know, and they've lost some members, but they've gained some members as well.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves. You know, another interesting kind of collaboration that's going on is JP Morgan, which left the R3 consortium. They're building their own. They're part of some other groups, but they're building their own smart contract platform called Quorum. They recently contracted with the team behind the Zcash currency, yep, to use that group's technology for the Quorum platform to sort of put a privacy layer on it. You know, one of the sticking points for banks is the radical transparency of the blockchain, meaning everyone can see everything. And if you're a bank, you don't want to tip. You know, you might want certain benefits of the blockchain in terms of efficiency,
but you don't want transparency necessarily.
Well, you don't want it. Well, I mean,
not public.
You know, you don't want to tip your hand to your competitors, and you don't want to reveal confidential client data. The Zcash technology is based on zero knowledge proofs, and the promise of it is that it will encrypt what's on the ledger, make it selectively decryptable, so that if you wanted to show your regulator that you're being compliant and you wanted to disclose the details of transactions to your regulator, you could do that selectively.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. All right, well, let's ask our next guest to join us, Mark. I know you know her, but it's Joanne Barefoot. She is the CEO of Barefoot Innovation Group. She has her own podcast. She advises, speaks, and works on projects around technology and regulation in both the US and globally. She's a senior fellow at Harvard University's JFK School of Government Center for Business and Government. That's a mouthful. She was an angel investor. She's on several advisory boards. She's the co-founder of a new reg tech company. I guess, Hummingbird FinTech, a new AML solution. We both know each other from working on the board for the Center for Financial Services Inclusion together. So, Joanne, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Hi, Brett. Nice to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, listen, as I mentioned, we're both on the board of CFSI. So, where do you think fintech can help us solve the problems of financial inclusion? And what are you seeing in both the US and elsewhere around the world?
Fintech is attacking all of the problems that people have in managing their financial lives, and actually can accomplish things that public policy has been trying to accomplish for decades, if not centuries. The biggest engine, obviously, just being the mobile phone, is bringing financial services to people who nobody was ever going to build a branch for and making it affordable to serve them. And then when you add into that the tools that make it easier for people to use, the conversation that you were having at the beginning with Greg Cross about having a bot that can talk to you and assist you. We're going to demystify finance and make it easy for everybody to manage our own bad habits as well as understand the complexity of the system.
So, in the old days, it used to be, there were two real hurdles to financial health apart from, just having money, right? And one was, this access to financial services, so sort of the regulatory side, so being able to have a driver's license or identity and being able to access a branch or whatever so you could open a bank account. And the second was this mystical thing called financial literacy. So is it your proposal that the tech that we're developing will essentially replace much of financial literacy, if not all of it?
I absolutely think so. People don't like to hear it, but financial literacy education and the way we've been trying to do it forever does not work. People don't retain it. It just has largely failed. Some people benefit here and there, but as a strategy, it fails. And instead of that, we're going to make it easy to get good information and tools and answers to questions right at the moment we need them. B, even more deeply, again, back to the Greg Cross conversation, I think we're going to move to a system where even if people don't have high literacy, they will be able to put some kind of a trusted player in place that can guide them in the way that an affluent person can have a personal advisor. And there's a lot of problems, a lot of things that could go wrong in that vision, but it's got the potential to be a complete breakthrough.
Now, the other element of this is RegTech and the technology that we look at in terms of identifying customers and things like that. So, we've seen, for example, with M-Pesa in Kenya. We've seen with Alipay and WeChat in China, Paytm and the Aadhaar card in India. We see a lot of parallel work being done on making it easier to get someone identified in the system so they can get access to some sort of mobile money account or things like that. How significant is technology reform and regulation to making financial services more accessible?
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. A big piece of it, as you say, is the identity area. It's easy if you've got a traditional form of documentation for yourself, but billions of people, about 2 billion people in the world, still don't have access to what we would think of as a bank type account. The World Bank has a goal of closing that gap completely by 2020, which we may not hit, but we're going to be pretty close to it. And one of the big reasons is that we're able to authenticate people's identities through data now instead of through government-issued documents. So that's got the potential then for regulators or governments to step in and begin creating much more efficient, effective databases for identity authentication. Again, scary stuff there around the potential for breaches or abuse, but nevertheless,
it's only scary if you're worried about civil liberties.
Privacy.
Yeah.
Although, is that a first world problem?
That's a great question. I mean, if you look at India, where they have put together the India stack and our product that is, or system that is identifying everybody through biometric identification. It's already transforming people's lives in India because they can, even if you're illiterate, you can get a bank account or make a payment. And if you're not illiterate, all the better, but you don't have to show up with your government-issued birth certificate to prove who you are. So it's huge. And then more broadly, RegTech, people use the term RegTech in two ways. One is bringing technology into the regulatory compliance function, which is an enormous need. The other is for the governments themselves to bring technology into how they're regulating. And part of the vision emerging there is to start to move the whole regulatory system. I shouldn't say the whole. Maybe there are parts of it that aren't appropriate for this. But big swaths of regulation from the analog era in which current regulations were designed, which are based on the assumption that data is scarce and computing power is scarce and expensive, and move it into a computational age when they're both abundant and cheap, and we can start getting good data, real-time data, full data sets instead of periodic reporting, and using machine learning to find patterns that are indicating problems. An example is market conduct.
So you might use some sort of network algorithm or sort AI tech that tracks flows of money. So instead of having to have a bank report on a suspicious transaction, you'll now be able to see transactions that are going off to centers of money laundering and financial crime in bulk. So you won't have to worry about individuals. You'll be tracking flows of money, stuff like that.
Stuff like that, and also stuff like identifying the typologies of laundering as they quickly emerge. You know, these things, we're doing this with Hummingbird. The criminals come up with a solution or an approach, and it spreads, and then the rest of it's asymmetrical, so the government and industry have trouble keeping up with that. We'll be able to share those kinds of typologies quickly, and it's not just money laundering either. Again, it's finding... market manipulation, terrorist financing, unfair and deceptive practices in consumer products. I mean, there's a huge
those pump and dump stock market, things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it.
Exactly. Australia's doing that.
Cool. So I want to talk about the startup in a moment. Just before that, though, Alex Jimenez, one of the fintech mafia. I'm having trouble talking today, Mark. What is with that? I haven't had enough coffee.
I need a refill on your coffee there, Brett.
He tweeted for us today, what about the U.S. regulatory view that financial inclusion means access to brick and mortar? So he's talking about the CRA. But we saw that in India as well. We saw India, they would mandated that 25% of all branches opened in India had to be open in rural locations. And then they did away with all of that with the Aadhaar card initiative. So how long before we see regulatory reform in the US around, access, financial access?
I think it is coming because it has to come. It is slow for sure. The regulators and a lot of the consumer advocates are very suspicious and very attached to branches. But if we force banks alone to keep that expensive delivery network up and running, then banks will be less and less competitive in the overall marketplace. And I think it just has to go. And again, the products can be better. I think we just have to convince people that that's the case, that fintech products offer the opportunity to give people much better budgeting tools, bill paying tools, savings, easy savings tools. I mean, you name it, whatever people need, they can do it more easily today on their mobile phone.
Very, very interesting. So tell us about Hummingbird. What are you guys doing?
Yeah, thanks. So Hummingbird is, RegTech is about 9 months old, and we're in pilot. We raised our friends and family round, and we are going to be doing a seed round pretty soon this summer. And our initial solution is an anti-money laundering solution that is aiming at the investigations portion of the work. So the numbers spent, the money spent on money laundering compliance, as you know, is billions of dollars. And we are
estimating
that we're only
globally, right?
Yeah, it's in the hundreds and hundreds of millions, certainly globally. And the we're estimating that we're catching about 2% of it with that spend, and a lot of that is because we just aren't going after it in an effective way. So part of the problem is that once something is flagged as suspicious activity, there's a very manual process, even in big companies, to do the analysis to figure out is it a pattern that has to be reported as suspicious activity, and if so, to put the documents together. So Hummingbird automates all that. It runs the analysis automatically and instantly. It produces a visualization tool that shows what the pattern is. What type of money laundering is it? Is it drug trafficking or human trafficking or what? It can catch early emerging new forms and so on. And then it's got geographic tools and documentation tools built into it. So we're cutting the time it takes to do one of these investigations in a typical U.S. bank from about 3 to 4 hours down to about 5 minutes for a typical case. And not cutting out the human analysis, that's still in there, but, auto-writing the first draft of the suspicious activity report and so on. And then once we do this, we'll have the archive of the company's money laundering typologies that are typical for it. And through that, then, we'll add in the transaction monitoring component, which is currently done now through tools that are basically rule sets, if this, then that kind of rules, and we are going to do it instead through smart machine learning-based pattern recognition that will just get smarter and smarter. And then the next stage is to begin pooling all these approaches. Law enforcement is extremely interested in this. We've got multiple agencies that are interested in using it for themselves, as well as the financial regulators intrigued with it, we hope. And, the whole ecosystem can start to get smart, and with a few regulatory changes, I hope also do more sharing of databases in a secure way.
Yeah.
So we could use
blockchain for that even, maybe. Mark, you had a question, yeah?
That's definitely part of the thought.
Joanne, there's an interesting phenomenon of what they call defensive filing of SARs, where banks, since I don't believe there's any penalty for filing too many suspicious activity reports, you have a lot of these filings being done. When we apply these technologies and this sort of more sort of sophisticated methods. To anti-money laundering, what do you think the net result is going to be? Are there going to be more suspicious activity reports because more things are being caught, or fewer because there's less sort of CYA type?
I think it'll be fewer and much more meaningful. It's not only that there's no penalty for overfiling, but there's also a safe harbor. If it turns out later that there was a problem and you did file, you're protected, and if you didn't, you're at risk from a regulatory standpoint and enforcement penalties, and as you know, the enforcement penalties are sky high. So, and if you talk to the end users, if you think about what is it we're trying to accomplish with all this, we're trying to give law enforcement tools for catching financial crime globally, and they will tell you, they tell us that a typical SAR reads like an encyclopedia and is practically worthless. And they have to spend time sorting through all that chaff to get to the little bit of important material in there. With our tool, the filing entity can populate the database, and then the law enforcement entity can come in and basically paste new material on top of it, and it will automatically find other relationships or other transactions that are related to the suspicious ones that we found by Hummingbird and First Tool. And so it just cuts everybody's time down and gets us to the important stuff.
So, you know, we've got a few minutes left, Joanne, but before that, I wanted to ask you, what does this mean in terms of regulators and the skill set they require to be effective? And secondly, you know, do the existing regulatory structures survive this in terms of the actual regulations and the regulators that oversee these markets, or is that going to ultimately have to change as well?
Yeah, I think it has to change. I'm a former regulator, former deputy controller of the currency in the United States. I have a lot of sympathy for the regulator situation and all this. You know, I think they have the hardest job because we're expecting them to not squelch good innovation, but still catch all these risks. And that's a knife edge because they're intertwined with each other, the good and the bad stuff. So the regulators need new skill sets. You know, we're looking at exponential change, and we're trying to deal with it with brains and institutions that are hardwired for linear, slow change. And especially the regulators are. They are designed to be slow and deliberate and so on. And then, as you say, we've got structural issues, especially in the U.S. We have 5 different federal agencies that directly supervise banks and credit unions, plus another 20 or 25 federal agencies that get involved, plus 50 state regulatory agencies. Yep. And I'm not planning to, I doubt I'll live long enough to see an optimized restructuring of the U.S. regulatory system. But I work with the regulators every day. Yeah. What they have to do is just come up with new models. You know, we may or may not do a formal restructuring, but they're going to have to create collaborative models where they're coming together, they're sharing knowledge, and especially they're sharing knowledge. I'm a big advocate of the sandbox concept. Let these regulators come together and work with innovation across their agency lines in sandbox or greenhouse or pilot project settings where they're getting close to the technology, they're hiring new kinds of skills, especially in tech, and getting sophisticated about it.
And again, fantastic.
It's not their fault, really. It's just where we are, but we're going to really need to accelerate some solutions.
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's definitely going to be some big changes. But I do see on the horizon some potential for that. You know, I had in the office yesterday, the Moovin office, I had the Fed, FDIC, and CFPB all coming in to talk about what does the future of fintech mean for regulators. So now, you know, it was a great opportunity. I was very happy to see them reach out and very happy to be a part of the conversation. So where can we find out about Hummingbird?
Let me just say first, they're all working on it. They're not sitting there oblivious, believe me. They're all working
on
innovation.
On it. Yeah.
So you can find Hummingbird at hummingbird.co, and we're very excited to launch. And
when do you think you'll be launching?
The whole sector. Pardon me?
When do you think you'll be launching?
Well, we've got pilots now, so we expect to be in bigger institutions later this year and big institutions next year.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you, Joanne, for joining us on the show today. It was some great insight. I'm sorry we couldn't get some more time with you. We've got a lot to talk about, you know, as we start to see some of these changes. But, let's get you back in a little bit of time and you know, get a bit more insights onto some of the RegTech technologies that are being deployed.
That'll be fun. And I hope everybody will come to my show, Barefoot Innovation, soon post my conversation with you, Brett, which was,
I think,
maybe one of the best we've ever had, maybe the best.
Wow.
And it was fun, wasn't it?
It was fun.
Over breakfast
always,
in London.
Always fun. Always.
Thanks for having me.
Very good. Thank you. All right. So earlier this week, I had the opportunity to interview Tony Sieber. He's a thought leader focused on energy and transportation. His new book, Clean Disruption of Energy and Transportation, has been making some amazing predictions for the near future. Now, you guys, if you've read Augmented Life in the Smart Lane, my book that came out last year, I talk a lot about smart infrastructure, robotics, AI, how that's changing everything. But Tony gave an even more aggressive timeline than I gave for the effect of solar and autonomous vehicles. self-driving EVs. And I think you're really going to enjoy the interview and all it implies about how quickly fintech and other solutions that are technology-based will be necessary and will change the way we live. Here's Tony Sieber's interview.
Okay, so this week we had the opportunity to speak to Tony Sieber. He's the author of a book called Clean Disruption of Energy and Transportation, How Silicon Valley Will Make Oil, Nuclear, Natural Gas, Coal, Electricity, Utilities, and Conventional Cars Obsolete by 2030. He also teaches at Stanford University's Continuing Studies Program, and he's involved with a new business looking at these sorts of changes in terms of smart infrastructure. RethinkX, is that what it's called?
RethinkX, yes. It's a think tank that focuses on disruption and its implications on society.
And so when it comes to the field of clean disruption, clean energy disruption, Tony is definitely one of the leaders. And recently, Tony, you got some big attention in the media across a range of article, a range of different media outlets, with your report that by 2030, 95% of people won't own a private car. So, first of all, tell us about that report.
It's called Rethink Transportation 2020-2030, and essentially we looked at the economics of transportation when there is a convergence of on-demand electric and self-driving technologies. And what we found out was that on the day, which we assume to be 2021, that what we call transport as a service, so on the day that self-driving is approved from a regulatory perspective, transport as a service will be up to 10 times cheaper than owning a car on a per mile basis, 10 times cheaper on day one. And essentially this 10x difference is gonna mean that it's going to disrupt the whole individually owned combustion engine car system that we've had for the last, you know, century. And transport as a service is going to even be up to four times cheaper than owning a car that you already paid off. So it's going to be four times cheaper than just the cost of gasoline and insurance and so on and so forth. So essentially, this is a big bang disruption. And we see that when we map out the disruption as other technologies in the past, 95% of the U.S. passenger miles will be in this new mode, transport as a system, on-demand, electric, and self-driving by 2030. So essentially 10 years after the approval of self-driving cars.
Now, what is the what's the potential disruption in terms of energy consumption with having that sort of system in place where people aren't buying their own gasoline-based cars anymore? How does that change energy consumption at a national level?
So energy consumption is going to go down, way down, because gasoline is very inefficient to, you know, refine and transport. And the internal combustion engine is also very inefficient. It's 17-21% efficient. So just converting it to electric vehicle is going to mean that it's going to consume 70-80% less in terms of energy. So overall, energy consumption is going to go down by an order of magnitude. Electricity consumption is going to go up. So we did the numbers, and when 95% of all miles traveled are electric, essentially it's going to mean an 18% increase in electricity consumption. But it's going to mean also a 90% decrease in overall energy consumption because of the efficiency of both the electric and the electric vehicle systems.
So we just, you know, I know we're recording this prior to the show, but over the weekend here, you know, we just heard news from Switzerland about the referendum where, you know, the Swiss people have pushed the Swiss government towards a cleaner form of energy.
Yes.
You know, when we see this at a national level, you know, sort of this differentiation, we see China cancelling production of coal factories to invest more in renewables, particularly solar. How big a differentiation will be, you know, clean energy ready economies and autonomous vehicle ready economies? Let's classify them as smart economies in
yes.
the future. You know, what sort of difference are we talking about in terms of GDP and sort of economics of an economy that sort of fully embraces this clean future in 20 years' time compared with economies that are slow to move off fossil fuels?
Yeah, so essentially the executive summary is that economies that keep running on conventional energy sources will not be able to compete with economies that run on clean sources. So this Rethink Transportation report found that essentially transportation is going to be 10 times cheaper using this new transport as a service. Electric, self-driving, and shared, 10 times cheaper. That means yeah. that logistics, transportation, any form of transportation will be 10 times cheaper. Competing with an economy that runs on combustion engine will be like competing, you know, trying, staying with horses and trying to compete with internal combustion engine automobiles. It just can't be done. If you look at the 20th century, the countries that dominated the 20th century economically were the countries that dominated basically automobile manufacturing, transportation, US, Germany, Japan, and so on. Similarly, energy, clean energy, especially solar, is going down in cost dramatically. It's not in this report, but it's in Clean Disruption. And it will be 10 times cheaper than conventional sources of energy. And again, you cannot compete with an economy that produces energy 10 times cheaper than yourself. So energy 10 times cheaper, transport 10 times cheaper. Either you go to clean sources, solar, wind, electric vehicles, self-driving and on demand, or you essentially take yourself out of the global race to be economically an economically viable and powerful country.
So what do you think when you hear, you know, when you heard in the run-up to the U.S. election, you know, Donald Trump saying we're going to bring back big coal jobs?
Yeah.
You know, as a guy looking at this, you know, what do you think that that means for the U.S. economy 20 years down the track?
There's really nothing that politicians can do. I mean, they can hold back the disruption, but it's only going to work in one country. I mean, all the technologies that for clean energy and transportation are global.
Yeah.
And, you know, even today, not in the future, today, solar in the desert, unsubsidized solar in the desert is already the cheapest form of energy, period. It's cheaper than nukes, coal, gas, anything, at less than 3 cents per kilowatt hour, and it's getting cheaper. So trying to bring you know, dirty energy jobs back is like trying to bring film cameras back. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen for economic reasons, not for any other reason.
Now, as we retool the world for this smart, you know, these smart economies, you're talking about a lot of infrastructure changes. You know, if you're going to have autonomous vehicles, assuming that most of them are going to be electric vehicles, you've got to have in place supercharging networks or, you know, recharging stations. If you're talking about solar, you move away from centralized generation in most cases to sort of these smart grids. How many people will we need to employ on a global basis to get this done?
If you look at solar in the U.S., solar already generates three times the number of jobs that coal mining does. So this is the building of a new infrastructure. It's essentially creating more jobs already, and it's just barely 1.5% of energy generation. So every disruption both creates and destroys jobs. And if we look at the telecom and the mobile telephony and internet infrastructure build out, it generated essentially all the wealth or much of the wealth that has been generated over the last 15, 20 years. If you look at the most valuable companies in the world in terms of market cap, Amazon and Facebook and Apple and Google and so on, they're all internet, mobile internet companies. So that's where the wealth is coming. And they create ecosystems of new jobs and so on. So essentially, we don't know necessarily the specifics of which jobs are going to be created, but we do know that a lot of jobs will be created. And just to give you an example, an average American family moves from car ownership to transport as a service, they're going to save $5,600 on average, each family in America. In an aggregate level, that's $1 trillion of additional consumer spending in the U.S. economy. $1 trillion. And consumer spending is 71% of GDP. So that generates additional economic growth in the whole economy. So a lot of the jobs that are going to be created by the disruption of energy and transport are not necessarily going to be in energy and transport, but right, they're going to accrue to the whole economy.
Now, you mentioned unsubsidized solar in, you know, desert areas like Qatar and, you know, Abu Dhabi, where we see these 20-year, solar contracts now cheaper than, fossil fuel contracts. But the argument you hear in the United States is about subsidies. But one of the ways we sort of try and talk about this is the levelized cost of energy production. Can you describe for listeners what that means, this levelized cost?
Yeah, that means that when you purchase a solar power plant or batteries and so on, you finance it as if you would finance your car over 10 years, over 14 years, over 20 years. And when you divide the production of energy over that time, then that's essentially the levelized cost of electricity. It's not a new concept. I mean, utilities have been using it for a long time, but not consumers, not businesses. So what utilities sell to us is their levelized cost of energy plus the cost of transmission and the cost of overhead and so on. So the user, the end user, that one of the big disruptive aspects of solar on the rooftop is that solar on the rooftop is becoming cheaper, not just than the rates that we pay utilities. It's becoming cheaper than the cost of transmission. That's what, right, I call God parity. So the moment... God, it's not so, solar.
I like it. Yeah.
Has been focused on, grid parity, which is the moment when solar falls below the cost that we pay the utilities. And according to Deutsche Bank, by the end of this year, 80% of the world will be solar, will be below grid parity. But what will break the bank, literally, of utilities is that when solar becomes cheaper than the cost of transmission,
right,
it means that even when centralized power plants generate at zero, when you add the cost of transmission, they can't compete with your own solar on your own rooftop. And at that point, essentially, it's going to be in every consumer's best selfish interest to own their own solar plus storage because it makes economic sense to them. And when I say consumers, I also mean Apple, and I also mean Google.
Sure.
They're going 100%,
of course,
because it makes economic sense for them.
So, I mean, how quickly is that going to happen? What sort of time frame?
Essentially, I see the solar has been doubling the installed base every 2 years since the year 2000. Essentially, the solar installed base has been growing at about 40-41% per year for 16 years running. And And now it's at the point when, as I said, it's becoming, or it has become, cheaper than the grid in most markets around the world. And I see 2020 as being the tipping point. Yeah. Basically, by 2020, solar plus storage, and so basically buying your own solar plus your own batteries, will be cheaper than the cost of transmission in most markets around the world. That's the tipping point. And at that point, essentially, everyone's...
All bets are off.
Yes. So it's over at that point.
Wow, that's exciting. 3 years away. Imagine, I mean, you know, if you're not planning for that already as a government or as a company or even as a consumer, then, you know, 3 years away is a lot of time. So, Tony Sieber, thanks for joining us again on Breaking Banks. It's always a pleasure, and I look forward to catching up with you somewhere in the world sometime soon.
Thank you, Brad. Thanks for having me.
So that's it. We've got about 3 years to prepare for massive changes in the way we consume energy around the world. And not only that, self-driving cars seem to be much closer than we thought. But the average American household saving almost $6,000 a year using on-demand transportation. That's pretty incredible. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. I want to thank our guests, Joanne Barefoot, Greg Cross, Tony Sieber. I also want to thank Mark Hochstein for doing his part and joining the show with me today. Please subscribe to Breaking Banks wherever you can, Google Play, SoundCloud, iTunes, etc. Or go to our website, breakingbanks.com, for more about today's guests and to check out the previous episodes on breakingbanks.com. Don't forget to subscribe to FinTech 5, Sam Moore's podcast as well. It is profiling all the speakers at Money 2020 and those making a splash in FinTech. So thanks for joining us. Hope you have a great weekend and the week that's left. And we will see you guys back at Breaking Banks next Thursday. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.